you sell $20 million of real estate that has $10 million of equity, you need to purchase at least $20 million of real estate with at least $10 million of equity. Because you also see some people will say, hey, well, I purchased the $20 million of real estate, I got a $12 million loan and I just cashed out $2 million. And yeah, no, you did. That's great. But it's taxable boot.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Michael Weiner, a partner at Greenberg Glusker in Los Angeles, focuses his practice on structuring real estate transactions in a tax-efficient manner and providing his clients with creative solutions to complex tax issues. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Sam. I'm really excited to be here.
Absolutely. The pleasure is mine, Michael. There are three questions I ask every guest who comes on the show in 90 seconds or less. Can you tell me, where did you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
Well, about 10 years ago, I had my own firm. I was just starting my own firm, doing some 1031 work. I wound up seeing an ad on the internet. I don't even remember what I was searching for an attorney to join a tax boutique in Century City here in LA. So I responded to the ad. Turned out it was a 1031 exchange specialty firm. And, you know, basically based on my practice and some of the clients I was doing work for, we knew a number of people in common. So I wound up joining that firm. It was a four-person firm. A few years later, that firm was acquired by a slightly larger firm. And then that firm was in turn acquired by a larger firm. And throughout it, I have to say, I'm really grateful. My traditional client base stuck with me throughout all the firm upsizings. And then from the larger firm, which is one of the largest firms in the world, I transitioned my practice with one of my partners and colleagues who have been with me since the smaller firm over here to Greenberg Glusker, which was a better fit. I'd worked alongside Greenberg Glusker on deals, both co-counsel and adverse, for many years, a phenomenal firm, and been here for about 4.5 years and love every day of it.
That's cool. And is 1031 what you still focus on?
Primarily, I generally wind up dealing with tax issues related to the real estate industry, and obviously 1031 is a big part of that. The last, you know, four-ish years, really since 2018, qualified opportunity zones have have become a bigger part of that. We also, being here in California, we have to deal with Prop 13, California property tax, and transfer tax issues. And then we also deal with partnership tax issues related to structuring joint ventures and real estate investments. And that then extends its way out to sort of syndicated tenancies in common and, you know, different ways of investing in real estate and being able to take advantage of all of the wonderful tax benefits of doing so.
That gets really complicated really fast for those of us that want to just go out and buy stuff and own and run real estate projects. You're a great compliment to our team, because the rest of us don't want to think about, you know, probably the things that you think about day in and day out. You know, specializing in this, I can only imagine. No 2 days are the same, would be my guess.
Oh, no 2 days are the same at all.
That's crazy.
Every day is a unique challenge, and every day is another opportunity to learn. So
what are some things, let's talk 1031, because you've touched on several things, and I know any one of these topics, we could probably burn the entire podcast, you know, going down that rabbit trail. But let's stay on 1031, because I would imagine that for the bulk of our listeners, that's probably something that is applicable. What are some common challenges, and what are some common misconceptions maybe that you run into when executing a 1031?
Well, the first thing that a lot of people forget about or just don't remember is that in addition to spending all of the money that you get from the sale of your relinquished property, you also have to replace your debt. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you see people from time to time who say, oh, yeah, no, we completed our exchange. We sold a property for, you know, $20 million with $10 million of debt. I bought a $10 million property. This is very, let me say, very simplifying the facts, fact pattern. We bought a property with with the $10 million. And, you know, we got this great deal. We only had to put $2 million, $3 million of debt on it. And we, you know, huzzah, we completed our exchange. And it's, well, no, yeah, I mean, yes, you did complete an exchange, but you're going to have boom. And it's very important to remember that. That gets especially tricky in a tenancy in common context, where you have multiple exchanges, investing, people completing multiple exchanges, investing in the same property, and they have to, satisfy their debt replacement requirements, especially if they had different leverage ratios on their upleg, and can wind up with a situation where you may need to invest some fresh cash in order to equalize it.
So let me see if I can summarize what you said. You replace one of the things that's often overlooked is that you replace the debt and the equity. So if it's a $20 million property that you originally purchased, and that was debt and equity, again, let's call it $10 million in debt and $10 million in equity. And then you sell that, you harvest, let's call it, it was a break-even deal, you harvest that $10 million in equity. You can't go out and buy a $12 million property with $10 million in equity and $2 million in debt.
Exactly.
You got to replace that debt.
Well, you can, you don't have to replace the debt per se. I mean, you can add fresh cash. You have to go basically equal or up in value and equal or up in equity.
Right.
So, you know, if you could put in $2 million of your own money, you know, non-exchange cash or money that you raised from an investor,
sure,
and then just get an $8 million loan, and that's fine. But too many people overlook that aspect of it.
And that is not an aspect of that I even understood until right now. So not just too many people, but myself as well. So yeah, that's really, it has to be equal or greater price point, period.
Exactly.
Than what you previously purchased.
If you sell, you know, using our fact pattern, if you sell $20 million of real estate that has $10 million of equity, you need to purchase at least $20 million of real estate with at least $10 million of equity. Because you also see some people will say, hey, well, I purchased the $20 million of real estate, I got a $12 million loan, and I just cashed out $2 million. And yeah, no, you did. That's great. But it's taxable boot.
Right. And you call it boot, B-O-O-T?
B-O-O-T is what the term is generally called.
Taxable boot. There's a new one. I'm going to put that in my newsletter.
That's, yeah, it's called generally defined as sort of money or other non-like kind property that right. You receive in a 1031 exchange.
Right. And so you can do it. It's just, you just have to know that whatever portion remains, you're just going to get taxed on.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. And maybe that's an acceptable, solution for some. You presented another wrinkle there that maybe, to hash it out again, you were talking about maybe, you know, let's use that $20 million example again. We'll see if I can craft this correctly. But I sold that, I owned it by myself. And then you sold another $20 million property. And together, we were going to go in and buy a $40 million property, right? But yep. Maybe your debt to equity ratio was different than mine was. And somehow you've got to get, we can go in as tenants in common buying this now new $40 million property together, both 1031ing into a bigger deal. But now we've got to figure out some sort of really complicated math as to how it's all got to work out.
Well, like, you know, let's say, you know, we're going to go in and buy a, you know, a $40 million property with $20 million of debt. And we're 50-50 tenants in common.
Right.
But my, you know, leverage on my downleg property was, let's say it was very, it was more highly leveraged. Let's say it was, you know, $15 million, just to take sort of an extreme example. Okay. When I go in to that, you know, $20 million property, I have to figure out, well, am I going to put in more cash? If I do, I can put in cash to equalize it.
Right.
And, you know, that'll be fine. But that requires me to come up with $5 million, you know, outside of, you know, outside of the exchange. And, you know, maybe I can go shake the money tree or something. But, you know, that's easier said than done.
Right. And so you help clients when they get into these situations where, especially, I mean, one or two is complicated, but I'd imagine 8, 10 on a much even bigger property than that,
yeah,
it becomes a bit of a, a bit of a process.
We have some pretty extensive Excel schedules, let's put it that way.
Right. I bet you do. And when people get into these situations, like, do you find that they come to you at the 11th hour going, oh crud, we didn't think through this and now we need help? Is that pretty common?
That's happened. The clients who I've worked with for a long time generally by now know to get me involved early. But it is, let's just say, not uncommon for people to come at the 11th hour. And, you know, we had one, you know, just a year ago that I can think of where, you know, literally a week before closing, we had to restructure significantly the transaction. The client scheduled it or structured it without tax advice, with three tenants in common, or they had tax advice, but not 1031 advice, with three tenants in common. And, you know, one was just a fresh cash tenant in common, not exchanging. The other two were exchanging. And basically, I, you know, took a look at it, and within 3 minutes, I said, oh, you're going to have, you know, $7 million of boot, of taxable boot based off of not replacing your debt.
Oh, wow. And
what we had to do was we wound up having to combine the fresh cash non-exchange tenant in common, make that part of the exchanging tenant in common. And that, using those numbers, allowed it to work and to get them to satisfy all the requirements. But you're talking about org charts already having been given to a lender. You're talking about documents already having been drafted and signed and having to go back to people and saying, well, you know, you were going to invest, because for the people who are investing in the, what I'm gonna call fresh cash tenant in common, there are, you know, a set of expectations with regards to your depreciation and outside basis in your joint venture. And these are technical terms, I know, but there are certain, let's call it, tax expectations that you would expect to have when you are investing in a non-exchanging entity, just in a straight real estate deal and a straight real estate syndication. And those things change a bit when you're coming into an entity, when you're coming into an existing partnership that is completing a 1031 exchange. There are different issues that you need to be mindful of, and they can be worked out, but, you know, people need to be aware of them. And people need, and documents need to, you know, need to address them and reflect them. And, you know, doing all of that a week before closing is, you know, lots of fun.
Is that what they call it?
I would strongly encourage people to, if you're doing a 1031 exchange, consult your tax advisors early.
Consult them early, absolutely, and especially
early, you know, early and often, I would say.
Right. And I would think, you know, on a single property, single investor, it's pretty cookie cutter.
Well, but yeah,
when you get into stuff like this, the complication factor just rises dramatically. So that's really, really interesting. And how do you feel like, when you're going back and dealing with legal? Because I mean, at this point, I imagine in this particular scenario talking about, like, you're getting legal on the phone, you're getting everybody on the phone to go back and start redrafting all of this paperwork and making appropriate changes. How is that interaction with, I guess, on the legal side of things? Like, is that a complicated, or is that a sticking point for you guys in your business where sometimes the legal side doesn't understand what you guys understand on the tax side? Or how does that work out for you?
I mean, and that's an important point, is that the clients need to have, for these types of more, you know, sophisticated deals, you need to have a sophisticated team all around. And that means, you know, both tax and legal. So that when, you know, we go and we tell the legal team, well, this is what needs to be in the operating agreement, and we get it back for review, that's actually in the operating agreement. They understand what we mean. They understand what concepts we're talking about. And they know how to draft those provisions. And, you know, if need be, then I will go in and, you know, draft those provisions or correct them as necessary. Yeah. You know, as tax attorneys, we still do a lot of drafting.
I bet you do. That's really cool. I love to hear the nuanced layers to things that are, I think, generally seen as pretty cut and dry, such as a 1031. It's generally like, oh, okay, well, we 1031, we bought one, or we sold one, and then we bought another one, and then we moved on down the line. But there's always another layer to what it is we're working on. And it sounds like you go many layers deeper than what many of us oftentimes see. So anything else on the 1031 front we should really highlight here that are things that either people get wrong, should be preparing for earlier, or are misconceptions? Anything else you want to hit on that front?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think when people hold real estate through a legal entity, through an LLC, through a partnership, mm-hmm. and if worse, through a corporation, I'll get to that in a second. People need to understand that it is that legal entity. It is the, you know, if you have a, so just by way of background, if you have a multi-member limited liability company, it is by default treated as a partnership for tax purposes,
sure.
for income tax purposes.
Yep.
If you have a single member LLC, it is by default treated as a disregarded entity for income tax purposes. In either case, you can elect to have that entity treated as a corporation for income tax purposes. That's very rare in the real estate industry. But occasionally you see it. But the important thing is that it's that entity that is doing the exchange. So you have a concept called the same taxpayer principle, which I know has been discussed on your show before, which says that the tax entity, the entity for tax purposes, the taxpayer that sold the downled property needs to acquire the upled property. And where that becomes tricky is where you have partners who want to go their separate ways. You know, they had a good run on the last deal, but now they say, well, we don't want to be together on the next deal. So to take, you know, the example one, or riff off of the example we were using, you know, you and I are 50-50 members of an LLC that is taxed as a partnership. And we had a really good run, and we, you know, our property did very well. And now we're going to sell it. We say, okay, well, what are we going to buy next? And, you know, I say, well, I want to go into industrial. You say, no, I want to go into multifamily, or you know, occasionally you have people that just don't like each other. Though I don't think that would happen with us, but you know, for various reasons, there are any one of a number of reasons why, when they're selling the property, they people don't want to be committed to investing in the next property together.
Sure.
And structuring those types of exchanges is very complicated, and it can be done. It can be done. There are several different structures and several different alternatives. I can get into them if you'd like, but they're somewhat technical. But that also requires consulting your tax advisors early and often.
Right. No, I can only and maybe even it isn't for reasons, it's not the partnership fell apart. Maybe you, Michael, just don't want to, you don't like the property that we're 1031ing into. Or it could
Yeah, I
be
mean, exactly.
you want to do something else. Like, that was fun. We had a great run, but I really don't want to move on with the next ones. And now we got to figure out a way to for say in
Or
this
in some
case.
instances, let's say I had inherited my partnership interest in our thing, in
Yeah.
our LLC. And I say, well, because I inherited it, I have a stepped up tax basis. I'm not going to pay any tax on a sale. I
Right.
want to sell for cash.
Right.
And
Yeah, because that opportunity to get that stepped up cash out basis isn't going to happen once you 1031 into the next property.
exactly.
It's got to happen now. Right. That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that.
I mean, so there are these situations which we deal with every day, and there are about 20,000 different variations of these that we deal with every day. It's very challenging. It requires a lot of cooperation. It's sort of like a three-legged race, probably the ultimate three-legged race. You need to get, you feel almost like a symphony, like conductor. You're like, okay, now you're doing this, now you're doing that, now you're moving here. Everybody needs to move in concert the documents. And there are a lot of documents on these deals. Need to all be, consistent.
Right.
And then when it comes to filing the tax returns need to be filed in a way.
I didn't even think about that. So there's, I'll give you an example. I was a passive investor in a, this is probably more relevant to our listeners, in a syndication. I was a passive investor in a syndication and the deal went full cycle in like, I don't know, 12, 14 months. I mean, it was great. Everybody doubled their money, loads of fun. And so they said, hey, you know what? We should 1031 this entire syndication into the next deal. Except there were some of us that were like, I don't need to. I don't like the next. And I, in my case, I was one of those people that I don't really like the next deal and I don't want a 1031. And I was an investor through a retirement account into that syndication. So I really don't care if I 1031 it's a zero tactical advantage or tax advantage to me. And so that was really interesting. And again, I got to sit in the sidelines and kind of just watch it. I just said, no, I don't want a 1031. And then of course, I don't know the volumes of documents and paperwork and new things.
So what what winds up happening is, well, there are a few practical points there. Most indications, the syndicator is not going to give you the option.
Right.
They're going to say, we are going to, we are going to 1031. If it's something that you think you may want to do or may want to have the right to, it's important to start talking about that early, 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 early in the process. Because then you can negotiate things into your joint venture agreement that will allow that. And the challenge is that once the cash from the sale goes into the 1031 exchange accommodator account, and to some extent even before then, it's really in a lockbox. You can't use it to just, I remember at one time a client said, oh, and if we need more money for that, we'll just pull money out of the accommodator account. I said, oh, no, you won't.
No.
First, most any accommodator that's really worth it won't let you. And even if they would, as your tax advisor, I wouldn't let you.
No, because you then you negate all of the potential savings of even doing the 1031.
You would blow your 1031 exchange.
Right.
So you have to come up with a way, and there are ways of generating that cash. Sometimes it's they find another person to come and buy you out, and that person is going to take your place in the partnership. Sometimes there is a a strategy that's used where the exchange accommodator will issue an installment note, a promissory note, to the partnership that is doing the 1031 exchange, and the partnership can distribute that out to to the investor that is being redeemed. If you're able to, and you're able to do this on time, namely before you really get into negotiating a purchase agreement, you can create a tenancy in common structure where the people who don't want to do their 1031 exchange get redeemed from the partnership in exchange for a tenancy in common interest in the property. And they then sell the property, you know, in a taxable sale. Right. And the people that are doing the exchange continue to just exchange.
And I'm pretty sure that was what happened. It's been a few years, so I don't remember the specifics of it, but I'm pretty sure I do remember seeing something about ticks in there and some other things, and it all worked out really well. But it was certainly interesting to see from the sidelines. We got about 60 seconds left here, Michael, and I did want to get your thoughts on this. Real estate held in a corporation, you kind of gave an indication that that was bad. Break that one down for me if you can.
Well, so first, there are just obviously two types of corporations for tax purposes. There's a C corporation and an S corporation. Right. A C corporation is taxed as a separate person. So it pays a tax. And then when it distributes money, the investors or shareholders pay tax on what's called a dividend or a distribution. An S corporation, the tax flows through to the shareholder. So you might say, well, how is an S corporation different than a tax partnership? That's also a flow through entity. And there are two primary differences and that are important when it comes to real estate. The first is that in a tax partnership, let's say you and I each put in $1 million into an LLC, and the LLC borrows, you know, $8 million and we buy a $10 million property. We have a $10 million between us taxable basis, each a $5 million taxable basis. And we can take depreciation deductions on that full $5 million, including our share of the debt. If we were shareholders in an S corporation, we would not get basis for that share of the debt. So we would not be able to get deductions passed through to us on that $4 million, only on our $1 million. The second problem with corporations is that when you distribute appreciated property out of a corporation, it's treated as a taxable sale by that corporation. So these types of structures I'm talking about, where people want to do different exchanges and create tenancy in common structures or do anything, that's really not possible with real estate held in a corporation. Because when you distribute that real estate out of the corporation, it's treated as though the corporation had a taxable sale of that real estate.
That is interesting. I wish we had more time to dig into that. I've got lots of questions on that front. Michael, it has been a pleasure having you on the show today. If our listeners want to get in touch with you or learn more about you, what is the best way to do that?
You go to greenberglusker.com. You can email me at mwiener.wiener@ggfirm.com. Or you can find my phone number on the website. I apologize, I don't remember what it is off the top of my head.
No problem at all. We'll make sure we include all of that there in the show notes. Michael, thank you again for coming on today. I do appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.